Women have been giving birth for centuries, so it's a pretty natural experience, right? Wrong. I'm Stephanie King, professional doula, childbirth educator, and the creator of the My Essential Birth course, the online childbirth education course that's helping women everywhere confidently achieve their best birth. Today's culture would have us think that birth should be treated like an illness or an emergency, and that most of us need other people telling us what's best for our bodies because we aren't the experts. So sit tight, because if you're tuning into this podcast, you'll probably start to believe in your body, your intuition, and find yourself empowered and confident to do what it takes to have the birth of your dreams. If you like listening to me take you through these weekly topics step by step, then you're going to love the My Essential Birth course. Make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast and definitely head over to myessentialbirth.com for the free downloads mentioned right here in these episodes and to join the birth course and community full of pregnant moms just like you. I have to add a disclaimer that I am not a medical professional and I cannot provide medical advice. All of the information expressed in this podcast are based off of personal, professional, and educational experiences and are my own opinions. Please work with a provider you trust for medical advice during your pregnancy and birth. Okay, it's that time for the reviewer of the week. And before I jump into that, I just want to say thank you so much to everyone who has left a review. Seriously, when you leave a review, that is what helps this show to jump up just a little higher and get seen by a little more women. And I know that you guys are loving it because I just keep getting tons and tons of information and feedback that you do. So if you are a listener and you haven't yet left a review, please do so. And then I hope that I can read it at the beginning of one of my episodes. So this week's reviewer of the week is Cass Clay 15. She says, first unmedicated birth went so smoothly thanks to this podcast. I seriously cannot say thank you enough for your amazing podcast. Although I discovered the My Essential Birth course too late in my pregnancy to make it beneficial to sign up, I was able to soak up so much knowledge by binge listening to as many episodes as I could. You are not alone. Binge listening is definitely a review I get regularly. I first started listening to My Essential Birth at 38 weeks, 2 days. I knew from the beginning of my pregnancy that I wanted to go unmedicated, but due to a busy home life and job, I pushed birth preparation to the back burner. You and me both. I've been there. Since I am a registered nurse, I was able to focus in on the episodes that would help me prepare mentally for contractions and how to achieve the natural birth I wanted while delivering in the hospital. Our birth went so smoothly, it feels like a dream. Even though the contractions were intense, I felt so ready for them due to what I learned from this podcast and truly believe me staying calm was how I was able to go from a 5 to complete in an hour and birthed our sweet baby boy after 4 pushes with absolutely no tearing. We are so in love with our baby boy and I feel amazing and so strong heading into postpartum. Thank you for your amazing podcast. Thank you for your review. And I think probably the number one thing that I end up saying to mamas that reach out to me or that say, look, I did this thing and thank you so much for X, Y, and Z is thank you for listening and putting it into practice. Thank you for listening and doing the work. You guys, that is what it comes down to. Watching you guys do the work, watching what happens when you do the work on the other side of things, it like makes my heart sing. This is exactly why I love doing what I do. It's seriously, I had that experience and why I'm like, I have to share this with the world. This was incredible. So I love it. I love that you guys are listening along and you're putting it into practice. Okay, this week's title hopefully threw you off just a little bit, right? Like, what are these lies that she's talking about? Truly, I think there's probably so many things that I can be talking about and I'm sure that you have your guesses, but I'm honest, like it's the simple things that'll trip us up the most when it comes to trying to create the birth experience that we're really aiming for. And so I'm hoping that I give you some more details about each of these 3 lies. And as I do that, that your mind is going to start sorting through all of that information and you're going to continue to build on that knowledge so you have it for when you need it. And I think overall, what I want is that I want you to realize how much power that you have over your birth experience and that you are truly the one in charge. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you each lie. I'm going to give you all of the nitty-gritty facts, and then I'm going to end with the truth. But I want you to remember, I'm not a medical provider, and I can't provide medical advice. I'm really just a birth nerd who loves to know what my options are when it comes to birthing, and then I like to take all that information and hand it back to all of you so that you have that knowledge, you can have an informed, educated decision going into your birthplace. But hopefully, this is going to get your wheels turning just a little bit. So what's that first lie that I'm talking about? This one is you're either too skinny or you weigh too much. You're too fat. This has to do with mom's weight. And I think it's important because I know that there are moms on either side that are going to have healthy babies. And what I'm talking about is you've probably heard that somewhere in the range of 25 to 35 pounds is about what you should be gaining. And anything less than that or more than that might be too little or too much. And so what happens when you don't fit into that, right? I've certainly had friends, I've had moms who have been in the too skinny category, right? They didn't gain weight until the end. Maybe they didn't gain much weight at all. Maybe they didn't show until the very end. And I might be talking to you right now, right? Maybe you didn't show almost at all during your pregnancy. And then you've got the other side of things, moms who have been too fat or they've gained too much weight. And those are moms, maybe you either started out a little overweight or your BMI was a little higher than you would like or that your provider would like. And you started gaining weight from the beginning. It didn't really slow down. Just as time went on, you gained more weight. And I mean, even I kind of fall into this category. I started off, I didn't weigh very much when I started, but I remember there were a couple of appointments where I gained 7 pounds and then I gained 9 pounds. And I remember my doctor telling me to watch my weight. There were no recommendations. I don't remember him saying, oh, be careful of your weight and here's some different things that you could do. Don't remember anything like that. But he told me things. I remember him saying, some women don't even need to take a prenatal vitamin because of how healthy they eat. Now, not in your case, right? And I'm just sitting there like, okay, like I'm not, you know, comfortable with the weight that I am anyways. This isn't easy for me. I'm not saying that out loud. I'm like having this conversation in my head, you know? But I'm just sitting there like, this doesn't feel good to hear. And in my heart of hearts was trying my hardest to like be healthy and make good choices and get good amounts of protein. And so it was a little tricky to hear that. So anyways, I think the important thing or kind of what we want to know is, does any of this make mom unhealthy? And so does it? And the answer is maybe. And so here's some things if you are concerned or if your provider is concerned. I'm going to give you a couple of things that you can, maybe questions that you can think about or things that you can kind of mull over in your mind or that a provider should at least be asking or concerned about. And that's things like, what's the explanation or reasoning for bringing up this information? Is it a benefit to mom to know like, hey, we probably need to work on this because of XYZ? Or is it just you're not fitting into that category? There's that 25 to 35 pounds. Clearly, you're not doing what all these other women do. Something is wrong. So I guess the question is there an actual medical issue? And then the stuff that maybe we don't want to talk about, right? Like, is anorexia involved? Is this something that a mom struggles with? Is this something that you as a mom have an issue with? Body image is a hard thing. And eating disorders are very real. And then when we add things like pregnancy and hormones, this is something absolutely to consider. Alongside of that is abuse. Is someone being physically, mentally, or emotionally abusive to this mother or to you? And so I hope that that's something that you can kind of reflect back, think back. This might not just be, this isn't just about weight, right? There could be other things going on. Is there drug or alcohol use? Prenatal depression? This is something that deserves its own podcast episode, and I should probably write that down. But legitimately, we talk about postpartum depression all the time, and I know that I've mentioned it on here, but I really probably even myself have not given it the amount of time and attention that it deserves. Prenatal depression is very real. In fact, it's like a very large percentage, and I don't have the numbers with me, but a very large percentage of women that experience postpartum depression have prenatal depression. In other words, these issues start prior to them having their baby. Having a baby exacerbates it and brings it kind of forefront. And so that is something to consider when we're talking about weight, because I'll tell you myself, I'm an emotional eater. When I get upset or when I'm sad, I turn to food. It is very real. And yes, I'm on the thinner side, but when you're already pregnant and easily gaining weight, when you add something like emotional eating, yes, that can certainly add to your weight. And that's not a good time to like, I gained weight, let's drop it, right? On the other side of that, some women don't eat when they're depressed. It's hard to eat. Nothing sounds good. They're not hungry. And so keeping that in mind, prenatal depression, if you yourself are finding you're either not gaining enough or you're gaining too much, and you're thinking, oh, I'm not feeling like myself, or because of how I'm feeling, I'm either eating more or not eating a lot, then maybe that could be like just something to have in your mind. Oh, maybe I should take that little test about prenatal depression. Okay, gestational diabetes is another one. Is that, are we gaining weight because we've got like a medical issue? Are there concerns for preeclampsia? Is there high blood pressure? Are there other things going on here? And then just the like simple, are you exercising, right? It's like, it seems so simple. It sounds so simple. We say it all the time, make sure to go for a walk and get 20 minutes of exercise. But really, like, exercise is kind of a big thing, even though it's such a small amount that needs to be done. And particularly for a mom who's dealing with other issues like prenatal depression or other things like that, it's going to be a little harder for that mom to find the energy to be excited about exercising, or to find the like ability in her mind to be like, I'm going to walk through that door and go for a walk. It's like even just the getting out the door is like the hardest part sometimes. So here's just some quick facts about exercising. Again, just information to have. So exercise alone prior to pregnancy, if you were exercising prior to pregnancy, and that can include like a 20 minute, 30 minute walk every day, it can reduce the risk of gestational diabetes by 55%. And if you start it during early pregnancy, it's by 24%. So in other words, moving your body matters. And I bring that up because it doesn't matter where you're at in your pregnancy, it's never a bad time to get going with this. I mean, it's something that I'm going to recommend anyways, like you should be moving your body for 20 to 30 minutes a day. That's walking or swimming or whatever you do for exercise. You can lift weights at home, you can do yoga. It's something that moves your body, gets the heart pumping. And preferably if you're able to do it outside, which I know, right, we're going to be getting into colder weather and all of that might be a little harder, but still, if you can do that, it's really, really good. The point being though, when we're talking about weight and what I hope you're getting from all this is none of this is supposed to be discussed in the context of weight alone. When we're meeting with a provider, if the only thing that's coming up is your weight is off for whatever reason, if you're just talking about weight, then that's not appropriate, in my opinion. I think it needs to be an entire conversation. It's about health, right? Like the overall well-being of the mother. And so I just want to share that with you, because if you are with a provider and you keep coming against this weight issue, maybe this will help you strike up a conversation about some of the reasons behind it, and being able to ask for help with it. I think too, there's kind of this emotional strain that comes from having conversations about weight with women in general, right? But even during pregnancy, when you're like, I know this is good weight, I know I'm supposed to be gaining weight, it's still not easy to see our bodies change all the time. And so to hear like from a provider, oh, you're gaining too much or gaining too little, it's like, how does that feel for her to hear? Like, oh, am I either starving my baby, or I'm getting my baby too big inside of me, or I'm gonna, you know, create health problems for myself. You know, it doesn't feel good to hear that. And it matters how we feel and how we're treated and respected during pregnancy. That's going to translate into how our birth goes, right? And so I was just thinking, and I know I've seen it done differently with different providers, but what if mothers were encouraged rather than told what they're doing is incorrect? And so I hope you're with a provider that is very encouraging. So in other words, kind of like flipping that narrative. For example, if a mom's having an issue eating, perhaps because it's, you know, she's nauseous, or maybe she just is not feeling hungry. Maybe as she gets, her belly gets bigger, like baby gets bigger and your stomach, you know, is squeezed into this tiny thing. Maybe you're just not feeling very hungry. There's the accusing or condemning and using fear to create the outcome, like you're not gaining enough weight and it's not good for you and baby. You need to eat more, so don't create it. You're not creating a dangerous situation for baby. You know, wouldn't you feel bad if not eating hurt your baby? Those are all ways of saying it that are super rude and not helpful, right? Or in my opinion, it could be more of like, let's have a conversation about her life and circumstances, and allow her to ask questions and educate with love, and something like, yes, I can see why it's been a struggle for you to eat. What are some things that you do enjoy eating? And then something like, that's great. It's great if you have those on hand and easily accessible. In fact, I think if we could add just one or two more things that have some higher protein that can help you get what you need and also support your growing baby, that would be awesome. So here's a small list. What do you think? And then asking her, like, do any of these look good? Do you have any questions? And then just being really encouraging. You're doing great. Feel free to reach out to me before your next appointment. Let's go over this next time you come in. I think that has a way different impact on a mom than saying you're not doing it right. Like if it's a positive encouragement, you create a positive environment, mom's going to feel differently. And that in itself is likely going to put her in a better position to be able to take suggestion and also do what is best for her and baby without doing it like under the guise of fear or guilt. And so I think that's really important. I will say, like, I think it's important for us to understand too, like, providers deal with all kinds of women. So there is a baseline that they're going off of when they're like, okay, this 25 to 35, right? That's like, I know in my head as a provider, this is a safe range. But I do think, and this is something I've always talked about in class and definitely in the birth course, but even when I taught in person, this is kind of my thing with medicine, right? Everything in medicine kind of works on a bell curve. And so with a bell curve, think of the shape of a bell. You've got it slopes and it starts going up on one side and there's like a peak and then it starts going down again on the other side. Think of a contraction, same kind of thing, right? So we're looking at this bell curve and the majority of people fit in between that bell curve. So it's like you've got that 25 to 35 pounds. That's within the bell curve. That's that safe space. And then you've got people over there that gain like 5 to 10 pounds, right? They're nowhere on that bell curve. And then you've got people that gain like 60 to 70 pounds, nowhere on the bell curve on the opposite side. The people on the left, people on the right, too little, too much, majority end up in the middle. But it doesn't necessarily mean that a mom on either side is going to be unhealthy or have an unhealthy baby. And so I want you guys to remember there, I mean, there's a lot that we can talk about, right? But as far as having a high protein, should be about 75 grams of protein or more a day, well balanced. So lots of fruits, veggies, good healthy grains, making sure that you're moving your body for about 20 to 30 minutes a day. And getting water and taking your prenatal vitamins, everything that you can do to remain healthy and low risk, that's going to be a beneficial weight gain for you. So I always say weight is just a number. As long as you are taking into account those other things, if you're, you know, eating Dr. Pepper and potato chips all day or drinking Dr. Pepper and eating potato chips all day, it's, you know, you might have some things that you want to change. And if you're certainly gaining weight and eating those things, like that's a different conversation. But if you're like, well, I had like a chicken salad for lunch and I had like two eggs for breakfast, and but I had that cookie after dinner, you know, it's balance. So it's all part of balance. So here's the truth. There is no perfect number for weight gain during pregnancy. When you're eating a high protein, well-balanced diet, and you're exercising for 20 to 30 minutes a day, you're going to reduce your risk of complications. It's going to keep you low risk and you gain what you gain. So there's your truth. Okay, lie number two. This one is your baby is measuring too big. We should move your due date. So this one has to do with the weight of the baby, not the weight of the mom. And what we're kind of up against here is we've got like a risk of induction, right? Because if your baby's measuring too big, then maybe we got your due date wrong and they're going to be ready earlier. So we should push up your due date. And then when you come up to your 40 weeks, which was really your 39 weeks, we're going to say it's time for induction. So that's, we're worried about that risk. There's a risk of baby getting stuck during birth or shoulder dystocia, right? Where one or both of the shoulders become stuck when they're coming out because baby's so big. That's not always the case. That's not always the reason for shoulder dystocia. And a baby that is bigger does not always become like an issue with this, but that's another thing that they're concerned about. They're concerned about the baby being too big to fit through the birth canal, fetal macrosomia, which is like literally, well, with fetal macrosomia, they can consider that a baby with a birth weight of 8 pounds, 13 ounces or more. And so I'm just going to say, like, women give birth to big babies, period. It is not on that alone, based on that alone, is not a good reason for a lot of things, but we'll get into it in a minute. There's a risk for cesarean birth, a risk of trauma to mom or the birth canal or the baby, if baby's so big. And so we want to talk about, right, who is at risk? So who, like, where do these big babies come from? The number one thing that we hear is gestational diabetes, right? And gestational diabetes, and it's true, women who have gestational diabetes are at a higher risk for having a bigger baby because there's a higher amount of blood glucose that passes through the placenta that goes to baby, and that extra glucose in the baby is stored as body fat. And so it can cause a big baby or that fetal macrosomia. And so there's different kinds of gestational diabetes though, right? There's the one that is managed with food and there's the one that's managed with insulin. And even within those categories, there's all different kinds of things that can go, that can happen there. And so gestational diabetes alone does not mean you will instantly have a big baby and instantly need an induction and you won't be able to birth your baby vaginally. That's not what that means, but it's on the list of like, this person would be at a risk for this kind of thing. If you've had a big baby before, and I want to say, though, too, if you've had a cesarean for your first big baby and you think it was a mistake, I think it's really important that you reach out for a second opinion. And what I mean by that is, say that your baby ended up being less than 9 pounds, right? Especially if induction was not involved. Or in other words, if they didn't induce you early and baby was not a big baby. So if you had, you were aiming for a vaginal birth, something happened with the cesarean and along the way, like something happened and you needed a cesarean birth, but baby was, you know, not even the 8 pounds, 13 ounces that, it, but for some reason, big baby was put on there. I would absolutely look for a second opinion on that. Now, if induction was involved, it doesn't immediately mean that it was because of a big baby. So the last 4 weeks, baby usually gains about a half pound to a pound a week, and that gives you an idea of how big your baby would have been. So say that they induced you because they said your baby was going to be real big, and they induced you at 38 weeks, but your baby was only 6 pounds. Well, they would have only made it to about 7 to 7.5 pounds if you would have hit that 40 weeks, you know, maybe 8 pounds by 41 weeks. And even then, your body is able to give birth to that baby. So just information for you to have. Also at risk would be someone who is obese either prior to pregnancy or becomes obese during pregnancy, or in other words, has excessive weight gain during pregnancy. I think obesity alone doesn't mean your baby's going to be bigger at all. It doesn't. But I do want to note here that interventions, including things like cesarean birth, have increased risk for obese moms anyways. And so if, I mean, there's a greater risk for blood loss. There's a greater risk for infection, complications overall. So it's still recommended to allow mom to labor, even with what they would assume or think is a big baby, to see if mom can, you know, finish the job before talking about cesarean birth, which again is, there are risks associated with that as well. And it also, I think when you're a bigger mom, it creates more of a challenge to be able to tell how big baby is, because a lot of times, and I'll get into kind of how they go over that in a moment, but a lot of times they use things like fundal height. And if you've got fundal height for an obese mom, a mom that's like, you know, pretty overweight versus a very like a thinner mom, it's going to be different. It's just going to look different. And so fundal height works to an extent. And especially, I mean, if you have a mom who's overweight and she's doing really well with like a healthier diet and stuff, she's naturally actually going to lose a little bit of weight even as she grows her baby. And so it just makes it a little trickier. And we know ultrasound, right? Ultrasound is not the most accurate, but I'll talk about that in a minute. I think the most important thing, especially if you're a mom that's coming in a little bit overweight or a lot of bit overweight, is to meet with a care provider who respects you. And I mean, I would say that to anybody, but I feel like, you know, you're going to be in a situation, you're very vulnerable and all this. You need to be with somebody who respects you as a person and doesn't just look at the numbers. So that's going to be really big. And the last one is going past air quotes, your air quote due date. Okay. Don't get me started. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But of course they'll say, oh, your baby's going to be so big if you pass your due date. Not necessarily true. And does it mean that any of these situations alone are definitely going to mean that you're going to have an issue with your baby's weight? No, absolutely not. So I think what I wanted to touch on here, let's get into kind of the details behind things. So how is your due date calculated? Okay, they base it off of your last missed period. That assumes that you have, we've been over this before, it assumes you have a 28-day cycle and that you ovulate on day 14. Why is this a problem? I'm going to give you an example. So for a mom, and I can relate, I might be this mom, for a mom that has 32-day cycles and ovulates on day 19 and her baby implants 10 days after that, because it takes 6 to 10 days for implantation to occur, it's going to leave mom at a minimum of 4 to 8 days off of what the provider calculates the due date as, meaning her due date's going to be a week earlier than when she would actually hit that 40 weeks. So when her provider says that she's 40 weeks, she's actually going to be closer to 41 weeks. And in a lot of ways, that's a benefit to her, right? Because she's way less likely to face an induction for being, quote, overdue. However, it can make it look like, oh, mom is measuring big for her gestational age. And so then there's a different risk for induction. It's like, oh, well, let's make sure your baby doesn't get too big. So just be aware of that. The second example is for a mom who has like irregular cycles, right? And she's not sure when she ovulates, or maybe she is sure when she ovulates, but her cycles aren't regular. So they're like 27 days and then 34 days and then 29 and then 31. They're just not regular. This mom is more likely to experience a push for induction for being overdue as she approaches her due date, rather than for a big baby, although it's likely that a big baby will still be brought up as part of the concern for you going past your due date. So I hope that that example kind of makes sense. So in other words, say that this mom who has these irregular cycles gets pregnant on one of her not 28-day cycles and then has kind of this longer stretch or shorter stretch and gives the doctor her last period, those numbers are going to be off because it's not every 28 days. And who knows? Maybe you have moms that can ovulate at day 10 or day 12. And so that puts them a little bit behind the curve. So in other words, when the doctor's saying you're 40 weeks, she's actually like 39 plus two. And so it makes it look like, oh, we got to get this baby out, or at least, you know, if we're going off of just basing things off of our numbers, when that's not actually the case. And it's important to note, remember, a mom should not even be considered, quote, overdue until after that 41 plus one. So topic for a different podcast. You guys have heard me talk about it before, but due dates are, they can be a little bit of a mess, and it's okay. And think about it. I was like thinking about, like, even when you take your pregnancy test, right? Like, when did it finally show you for you? When did it finally show you that you were pregnant? And if I'm guessing correctly, I'm going to say you probably took more than one, like early, right? Because we all do it. And so I, being honest, like, I never paid attention to any of this until we tried and couldn't get pregnant. I was thinking back though, and I always did the first response, right? Like, that's the test that you take that's supposed to tell you, like, before your missed period, if you're pregnant. And of course, I had buy several, and literally every single time, it wouldn't tell me until after the day of my missed period, like every time without fail. And I happened to have 31 to 33 day cycles. I didn't know about ovulation and stuff when I was trying to have my babies, like, until we couldn't get pregnant. And then I went back. And when I went back and started testing for that, once I was like paying attention to my ovulation, I realized I ovulated later. And that was any day or anywhere from day 17 to 22, which is like a huge gap, right? And much later than that 14 days. And so again, benefit to me, right? But at the same time, like, women don't typically know that, or if they do, it doesn't matter because it's not really calculated. Now, I have seen a couple of providers that do take that into account, but the majority are going to go off of that last missed period. So just information to have about how due dates are calculated. And then here's the thing about, like, kind of where they get it wrong. And this matters because ultrasound, between fundal height and ultrasound, right? These are the two. Ultrasound is the one that's like, oh, for sure, your baby's measuring big or your baby's measuring small. And the truth is, ultrasounds can be pounds off, give or take. And I mean 1 to 2 pounds off, give or take. That's the difference between a premature baby and a thriving baby. I mean, it's huge when you're talking about the weight at the end of the month here, or at the end of the pregnancy. And so they are notoriously wrong. And that means regularly wrong. So I want you guys to look into it. Do your own research. Type it in. How often are ultrasounds correct to measure a baby's weight? Look up ultrasound accuracy for weight measurement. I don't know. I mean, whatever you can type in, you'll come up with your own things, and not just like blog posts and whatever. There are studies. They are notoriously wrong. So it's actually not an evidence-based practice. And so if your provider's coming at you with that, you gather your research, you get information. Obviously you want a provider that you trust, but you also have a say in some of these things, or in all of these things. And it's really important that you have that information so that if you choose, well, even if I'm having a big baby, I'd like to give it a go, you have that option. The other thing that they use is the fundal height. And that's where they measure from your pubic bone all the way to the top of your fundus. And that they're look, I mean, anything can change that. If a baby's in a different position, if they're up higher, if they're down lower, if they're turned to the side, and the amniotic fluid. Some moms have a ton of amniotic fluid. Some moms have, you know, a normal amount. Other moms have a bit less. And so fundal height is not accurate either. So it's good to like put all the information together and then obviously use that with your medical information and on the side too. Because yes, I'm like talking in generalities here. And like if you have like, oh, I have gestational diabetes and my fundal height is super like, you know, measuring a ton and the ultrasound and my doctor says like, that's a different situation. So it's information for you guys to have so that you can kind of work this through to your own personal situation and to trust your intuition. But it's information that I think is really important for you to know. So the truth, it's a cop out. There, I said it. There are actually times where this is the case, but most often it's still best to give labor a go before resorting to immediate intervention such as induction or cesarean birth. Lie number three. Being GBS positive means I can't have the birth that I want, the one that I planned for. Let me tell you a little bit about what GBS is. And let me tell you that as I was creating this podcast outline, I went pretty deep and I am likely going to create an entire separate episode all about GBS. So I might kind of fly through some of this information or leave you a little bit like, wait, what does that mean exactly? And if that's the case, I hope I have a GBS episode coming soon, but if not like super soon, then in the coming months, because I think there's a lot of information to get into behind GBS. And really what I want you to understand is what that does it mean I can't have the birth that I want? Does it mean it's going to change things for the birth that I planned for? That's what I want you to get mainly out of this before diving super deep into everything that GBS is. But I do think we need to start with that. So what is it? It's group B strep, and it's a bacteria that lives in the vagina and rectum. So the truth is any mom may or may not carry it, and they're going to test you for it while you're pregnant between 35 to 37 weeks. So it's a little swab. They swab your vagina. They swab your rectum. It takes about 48 hours to get it back. It goes through some lab testing, and they tell you, yes, you either have GBS, you're GBS positive or you're GBS negative. So the concern is because it can be passed to baby during birth, if a mom is actively like she's GBS positive. And these are like the big scary things. Okay. So I'm going to say them, but I want you to understand, I'm going to go into a little bit of the background information, like the details of like how many children get what we're going to talk about. So don't freak out. Okay. But sepsis is one of them, and that's like extreme infection response, right? Meningitis, that's obviously that inflammation of the tissue that covers the brain and the spinal cord, and that's, you know, one of the vaccines that are given to baby has to do with meningitis. Pneumonia, and that's obviously an infection of the lungs, causes breathing issues. And then like on the extreme, it can cause deafness, developmental disabilities, and obviously death. So because when it does create an issue, the issue is extreme or heavier or bigger, I think that's why it's given so much attention, and, you know, rightfully so, that if we've got these things that we can prevent, then we need to talk about them. So anyways, here's the tricky part and kind of the controversial issue, right? Especially when we talk about testing. So mom can test positive for GBS during pregnancy and be negative at birth, and vice versa. So mom can test negative during pregnancy and be positive at birth. So it's moms are like, well, then why am I testing? Or what are my options? Like if I'm negative now, but what if I'm going to be positive then? Why aren't you offering me antibiotics? And if I'm positive now, but I could be negative then, why are you offering me antibiotics, right? So it's kind of this back and forth. And there's been some, I remember, and they've actually been working on it since and this is why I dug so deep, because I'm like, oh, there's like new studies and all, anyways, from like even when I was teaching a couple years back. And so they've been working with this, the idea, right, the gold standard or what they wanted to be able to do is be able to test a mom during labor and decide, oh, she is GBS positive or she's GBS negative and she needs the antibiotics or she doesn't need the antibiotics. And that would be beautiful because then you don't have to worry about it. And it doesn't necessarily have to affect your labor in any given way. But that rapid test, as they're studying it, at least for right now, is not super accurate. And so they were concerned we're either going to miss cases or we're going to have false negative or false positives. And either one of those could be like, you know, obnoxious for one reason or another. Here's the thing. You can deny the testing and don't get after me. I know there are going to be medical people listening to this. My job here, or I mean, I make it my job, right? Because I work for myself here. What I want to do is give moms all the information so that you have power. You have what is true informed consent, meaning you have all the information and you've made an educated decision off of good information on both sides. I'm going to tell you right now that whatever you choose to do, I support. I'm not here to tell you one is better than the other or anything like that, but I think it's really important that you know you have the choice. So how likely is your baby to get GBS? So I did look up the data. I pulled what I could. 3.6 million babies are born each year in the United States. Of those, 930 will get early onset of GBS. Just for a percentage, and yes, I know that there's the argument, well, yeah, because we get so many people that test positive and we give them antibiotics and that's why they don't get it. Even those with antibiotics, it does not make it 100%, and some of them will get it. And those who don't know they're positive may not get it at all. So that it's just information. But I want to be clear, that's 0.00025% of babies born will get GBS. Of that 0.00025%, 4 to 6% of that percentage will die. Or in other words, it's 2 to 3 out of every 100 babies. That get that early onset of GBS. And I think they say it's 2 to 3 out of every 50 babies that get either early or late onset, but I'm just talking about early onset. To give you a little bit of perspective, babies that either are premature or experience meconium aspiration or SIDS, those are much greater risks to baby, especially in the way of death. And I think numbers matter. And so I don't know. It's just really important information to have instead of making it sound like this big scary thing and you only have one choice. Well, there are some scary parts to it, absolutely. And you have every right to know those and to think about those and to make a decision on those. But I do think it's fair that we talk about it in the right way, that you have all the numbers, all the information. You can really look at the data, the percentages, and say, I choose to do this or I choose to not do this. So I think, too, when you're discussing it with a provider, I think that information can come across very differently. And so it's just back to informed consent for me. I don't think it should come from fear mongering. And even if somebody has a personal decision for themselves or a personal thought for themselves, I think it's up to a mother to decide for herself, her and her family, what is best for them. So here's how to protect a baby with antibiotics, because if you are GBS positive, they're going to recommend that you have antibiotics during labor. So I thought this was interesting too. I didn't know this, which is interesting for myself because I am allergic to penicillin. And so if you are one of those people that's allergic to penicillin, right, the next thing that's typically offered is clindamycin. Now, I was happy. Apparently, it's like almost 60% less effective if you use clindamycin. So if you happen to be one of those moms that is allergic to penicillin, they're probably going to do this anyways. But in the back of my mind, I would just want to make sure that it's the correct one. They're going to use something called cefazolin. And so that one's supposed to be much more effective than clindamycin. Nothing is as effective as penicillin from what I read and understand. So, but just information for you to have, right? So the doses would be given every 4 hours, beginning at least 4 hours before baby is born, ideally. And just so that you're aware, they want you to have at least 2 doses before baby's born. But that first dose, and if you can have it 4 hours before baby's born, is 90% effective. And less than that, if it's less than the 4 hours, it can be anywhere from 35 to 50% effective. That's like the 0 to 4 hours, 2 to 4 hours. That I all kind of like ran into the same information, 35 to 50%. And so I think what women are wondering is like, okay, like how does that affect my birth, right? Like what does this mean for my labor? Am I going to have to come in way earlier? And let me get into those questions because I wrote them all out because I wanted to make sure that I know what you guys ask me like all the time. And it's normal questions that of course you have, and I want to be able to answer them correctly. But really quick, let me touch on this before I jump into that. I know a common question is, well, why doesn't everyone choose to get the antibiotics? Why wouldn't you do that? Like, if you have the opportunity to prevent this thing, why wouldn't you do that? And so I want to kind of speak on some of those women's, not really on their behalf, but like to what they're concerned about. And so I think the big concern is when you're introducing an antibiotic, it kills bacteria. But it kills good bacteria just as well as bad bacteria. And when you've got a newborn baby, especially, you're talking about their gut microbiome and their good bacteria that's in their bellies. And so there actually are studies that have shown that the antibiotics that is given for GBS, while mom is going through labor, it does affect the baby's gut microbiome. And that can cause issues, as we know, right? Moms who have had antibiotics during labor, they have issues possibly with yeast and thrush. So if you're breastfeeding and there's that like white creamy and it hurts the nipples and you see like this, you know, this kind of like film on baby's mouth and stuff, it can make breastfeeding difficult, and it affects the baby's immune system, according to these studies, for more than a year. So, and that can be like a maybe forever thing, I don't know, but it said more than a year, which I think is kind of crazy and something to consider, because if you don't necessarily need this thing, then obviously we'd like to leave all of that good stuff alone, everything that baby needs when they get here to this earth. So here's the questions though, and we're chatting about that birth plan. And what I think most women worry about is, I want to give birth unmedicated, or I want to at least, I want to spend a lot of time at home before I come into my birthplace. I don't want to have to do the majority of my labor at my birthplace. So if you choose to get the antibiotics, yes, that's true, because they'll tell you you need to be at your birthplace at least 4 hours before you give birth. But remember the numbers that I talked about before. So that first dose is about 90% effective if you get it the full 4 hours before baby's born, and about 50% effective before that. It still cuts your odds almost in half no matter what, even if you're getting it, you know, an hour or two prior to baby being born. Now, you're not going to like me for this next one. But here's the truth. And so I don't want you... I hope this gives you a little bit of peace of mind, is what I'm hoping, honestly. But most moms, even when they're trying to get to their birthplace, closer to pushing, right? Because the idea is like, oh, I want to like step out of the car, and they're going to tell me like, oh, wait, let me get the doctor. We're going to have a baby. And that does happen for some moms, even first time moms. I'm not going to deny that that happens. An excellent, great job if it does. Okay. The truth is, you're probably still going to end up at your birthplace close to 4 hours before baby comes, even if you're like really aiming to be there towards the end. So I want you to know that, but then feel free to ignore it, except for the fact that I hope that it should make you calm. Does that make sense? I hope it does. So 4 hours before birth, if you're trying to decide, okay, so when do I leave my house? It can still look like 3-1-1 or 4-1-1 if you're really concerned and want to be there on time. So that means contractions are 3 minutes apart, lasting for a full minute for at least an hour, or they're 4 minutes apart, lasting for a full minute for at least an hour. Using those will still get you there at a decent amount of time to be able to receive the antibiotics if that is what you choose to do. Now, how about the, I didn't want to have an IV, it's going to ruin my freedom of movement. What about the IV? So here's where I really want to like give you some power and freedom and all that good stuff. So you can totally ask for a heparin or a saline lock. And that is when they administer the IV, but they pull the tube out. So it's left in your arm, and they kind of like wrap it around. And so they can come and give you IV fluids at any time. But in other words, you're not hooked to the IV machine. You can move around. You can get into water. You can walk down the hall. You can be on the birth ball. You can do whatever you want to do. You don't have to be hooked up to it all the time. And so when you get the IV antibiotics, it from what I've seen for sure, like they say sometimes, and I'm like, yeah, majority of the time, I feel like if you're getting the antibiotics, you're going to feel some stinging and burning. And it takes about 15 to 30 minutes to get the full dose. And so you'll feel that stinging and burning as they do that. And then you can ask to have it flushed and go back to the saline lock. And then if you want to get into water, whether that's like a tub or a shower, they can wrap the area so that it like doesn't get wet or anything, you know, there's no issues with it. And then you can go into water. If you choose not to receive the antibiotics, because yes, just like the test, you can deny the antibiotics. So if you come up groupie strep positive, you can choose whether or not to receive the antibiotics. Again, something I want you to do a little bit more research for yourself on, use the numbers and information that I gave you. I'm going to link to a study and the CDC information in the show notes so that you guys can go click there and read around and get information on your own. But if you choose not to receive the antibiotics, then you don't have to worry. If you don't want an IV, then you don't have to do an IV, which is nice if that's your choice. Okay, the next one is, I don't want to be stuck on the monitors the whole time. Okay, because we assume as soon as they're going to do any kind of medication or whatever, you're going to be stuck on the monitors the whole time. And that is just simply not true. So even when you have, like, you're getting the antibiotics, and they do generally listen to baby at the same time because it just makes sense. You're maybe lying in the bed, or they know that you're going to have to be hooked up to something and at least have your IV going. And so if that's the case, you can just have them. But you can still sit next to the bed. Like, you don't have to be laying down in bed if that's not comfortable. You can sit next to the bed on a birth ball. You can use a peanut ball and be on your side. Like, you don't, and it doesn't really restrict you, even though you're, you know, stuck next to the bed maybe because you've got the IV. But it shouldn't really restrict you. And so it's the same with the monitors. There's no need to be on them the whole time. Antibiotics is not the same as getting Pitocin. It's not the same as getting an epidural. So you don't need to be monitored, you and baby, the whole time. You can still do the intermittent monitoring, which is about 20 minutes every hour. So keep that in mind. And if for any reason you're getting any flack about that, you can kind of remind them, like, no, this is fine for intermittent monitoring. And definitely have that conversation prior to going into your birthplace. Another question is, well, what if my water breaks? Like, won't that increase my risk of infection for baby getting GBS? So a prolonged bag of water is broken does increase your risk, but that increases your risk of infection with or without GBS. In fact, the number one risk of infection once your waters is broken, and I know some of you have been answering these questions for me recently on stories and Instagram, is vaginal exams. So if your water breaks, whether or not you have GBS, you know that you're positive or not, you shouldn't have vaginal exams, or very, very few. And I mean, like, 1 to 2 at the most. They're not necessary and they cause problems. So if your water breaks, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. It doesn't mean, oh my gosh, I have to go into the hospital right away. Although it's likely that contractions are going to start shortly after that. And if you want to get to the hospital, you know, I tell you to go through that taco, like, time, amount, color, odor. So what time did it break? Have that information. How much was it? Was it a trickle or a gush? Does it, what color is it? Is it totally clear? Is there, like, is it sludgy? Is it green? Is it brown? And then what does it smell like? Does it kind of smell like salt water or like nothing? Or does it have kind of like a foul or like an interesting odor that should be taken care of? And if all those things check out and it's pretty normal, it doesn't necessarily mean, especially if contractions haven't begun, that you need to go in right away. However, that is a conversation for you and your provider. I can't give you medical advice. So make sure that you have that conversation before your water breaks so that you know what to expect. And then how about, I wanted to give birth in the water. Can I still do that? Yes, 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 you can. So this is kind of cool. And I'm going to include this study as well. This one shows that low risk women giving birth in the water actually creates less of a risk for baby developing early onset of GBS. And so I think that is super awesome. In fact, I've included that study in the show notes so that you can look at, because it's so interesting and so cool that it's like, oh, well, maybe I should give birth in the water because I'm GBS positive, right? So that's good information for you to have. Really quick, the prevention. So I think prevention is the best medicine, right? It's the same with, like, we talked about the weight and stuff. If you can exercise and eat healthy and all of that, great, you're going to be healthier and low risk. Well, another thing, they've got another study, and that study says regular probiotic use has been studied and it does decrease GBS in pregnant women. And so if you are taking a regular probiotic, then you will have less of a chance of testing positive, but not just for the test, you'll have less of a chance of being GBS positive, which is awesome. And I know there are other, like, natural things that you can try to do, right, to trick the test. Like, that's what women talk about. Like, oh, if you insert garlic, it can create a negative test. And I've looked into this because I was, like, totally willing to do this. I didn't want to have to deal with GBS and antibiotics and whatever else came with it. But the garlic, while it might create a negative test, it doesn't mean that it has cured you and that you will be negative when you're giving birth. And so if you were like, well, yes, I want to know, which I think is smart, right? If you're going to take the test, then let's make it correct. Whether or not I'm positive or negative, because I worry that if I am, like, I do want the antibiotics or however you want to do it, then just so that you're aware, if you insert the garlic, it can trick the test, but it doesn't solve the problem. And then that's, this is kind of cool. And again, probably conversation for a different day when I do like a little longer GBS episode, which is a little more detailed. But HipaCleanse is something that can be used in place of antibiotics, which again will be a conversation for a different podcast. But however, women try to use it for the testing, and what it's the same thing as the garlic. So it can make the test result negative, but it doesn't make you negative. However, you can use it, and midwives do use it postpartum once baby's born for prevention of GBS early onset. And so that's really neat. And I'll put a link for HipaCleanse, just so that you can see exactly what it is in the show notes as well. So the truth for GBS, if you choose to get tested for GBS and you test positive, you have options to choose from, and none of them will keep you from having the birth you want. All right, as always, I hope this information causes you to think about what this could mean for your birth, right? The whole point behind digging deeper, and for me, getting into the details is that so you can make an informed decision and an educated decision. Of course, there's going to be more for you to research and to review, and information that you can go after and kind of figure out. And it's really important that you speak with your provider, obviously one that you trust along the way. But I hope that you take this information and you're like, oh, it's making me think. I have things in the back of my mind. There are things that I can do to prevent. There are things and information out there that I can like research and decide what I want to do for my body and for my baby. That is like my big soapbox, right? Informed consent and getting you guys to a place where you feel like you are in charge of your birth. That is the big deal here. So again, I know this was kind of crazy and I threw a lot of information at you, but I just want to tell you, if you guys have any questions or comments after listening to this episode or any of the episodes really, feel free to reach out to me. You can always reach me, and probably the quickest way is to hit me up on my DMs and Instagram, and that's at myessentialbirth, or you can send me an email at hello@myessentialbirth.com. So thanks for listening, and I hope you have an empowered week.
That's it for this week, but make sure you subscribe to the podcast so that you get notifications first as I drop a new episode every week. And don't forget to head over to myessentialbirth.com for all of the free downloads mentioned here and to join the birth course and community serving pregnant moms just like you. If you enjoyed this and other episodes, I would love it if you would take a few minutes to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I read every single one and include one at the beginning of each episode. See you next week.